you can host the best backyard barbecue. When you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
I'm George Chen.
I'm Paco Romaine, and you're listening to SupDoc, where we celebrate the good, bad, and ugly of all things ducks, with insightful interviews, unscripted humor, games, and the occasional horrible impression.
Today we sat down with writer Tony Duchesne. Tony is the author of Confessions of a Teenage Jesus Jerk, published by Softskull Press, and now a film directed by Eric Stoltz.
His writing has appeared in the Los Angeles Times, Mother Jones, The Rumpus, and The Believer. He was a music columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle and wrote hundreds of articles covering books, film, and music.
He also teaches novel writing at UCLA Extension. Tony wanted to discuss the 2014 experimental and musical documentary 20,000 Days on Earth, directed by Ian Forsyth and Jane Pollard, which depicts a 24-hour period in the life of musician, actor, composer Nick Cave.
Tony's film, Confessions of a Teenage Jesus Jerk, premiered in Los Angeles on February 24th and is available for viewing on Amazon Prime.
And now, here's Tony Duchesne.
We are here on SupDoc with our guest, Tony Duchesne.
Hey, thanks, guys. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you. Thank you for coming. Tony and I are in lovely San Francisco, and we're here with my co-host, Mr. George Chan.
Yeah, even though Tony and I live in the same neighborhood in L.A. and have run into each other randomly. Tony, you wanted to talk about Nick Cave, but we know a little bit about you. Why were you so interested in Nick Cave?
I developed a weird obsession with Nick Cave in 1990. I started doing college radio at KFJC.
Oh, yeah. Great station. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And the other DJs were like, we have to go see Nick Cave. And I was starting to learn who he was. And in those days, you didn't have, you know, this is like pre-internet or whatever. So the only things you had was the vinyl and his photo and the photo of the Bad Seeds. And they were always in suits. And they looked like they were just... You know, they were singing these beautiful kind of love songs and twisted, fucked up love songs that had violence in them. And it looked like these guys were just in suits and wanted to kill you.
Yeah.
And so my interest, I went and saw Nick, and I was just enamored by him, as well as the religious symbolisms. I was coming in and out of because I grew up a Jehovah's Witness. So that kind of meant a lot to me. It was a little bit of my soundtrack of understanding that there's a lot more to life than inside the Jehovah's Witnesses.
Yeah.
I mean, there's so many levels of why I love Nick. And it's been like a weird obsession for many, many years.
My connection to Nick Cave also has to kind of deal with college radio, I think, because I was going to an all-boys Catholic school. Sounds like it kind of mirrors your experience in a weird way. And then I just remember hearing, or maybe I taped it. It was back when you had to tape college radio. And it might have been KFJC, but it might have been KSJS. But it was just him playing piano, and it was Mercy Seat. And I had never really heard anything like it before. And I'm trying to remember if I saw that, and then I saw Wings of Desire later, because Wings of Desire, I think, made the art house rounds. But yeah, so my kind of first introduction to Nick Cave was like, probably hearing Mercy Seat, which is all about religion, and while I'm going to this Catholic school where I'm pretty much like an agnostic. So it's kind of a weird mirroring. But yeah, growing up in Jehovah's Witness, I think, Paco, you could probably relate to some of this as well, because you grew up in a pretty religious situation as well.
Situation is the operable word there. If you grew up in any like strict religious household, it's definitely an operation. I grew up in and my best friend grew up a Jehovah's Witness as well.
Oh, yeah.
And I would sneak him birthday presents.
Oh, yeah. That's sweet. What did he do with them? Because I'm sure he felt a little guilty about it.
No.
Okay.
No, he wanted out pretty quickly. His mom is like just the most Jehovah, the biggest witness that Jehovah's ever had. we call him the Jehovah's Witless. Because in Michigan, Michigan's got this weird Bible Belt thing.
Really?
That runs through it. Yeah, there's so many different kinds of religious freaks up there.
Huh.
Yeah. My dad was one of them, and he was free denominational. you know, Pentecostal kind of person. Yeah.
Pentecostals are interesting, man.
Yes, they are.
Yeah.
Yeah. We went to an Agape church. Okay. You know Agape?
I know the name because we always used it in, you know, learning the Bible and all that.
Yeah. It's kind of like for wayward soul types where it's like the big mega churches in like SoCal. Those are all like Agape.
Yeah.
Where it's like people who are like, I'm not Jewish and I'm not Methodist. I'm just like, I used to do a lot of drugs. Now I want God in my life.
But okay.
So they're like the worst kind.
Is it the worst because they have like a loose practicing thing where it's almost like it's disingenuous?
No, it's they're super judgmental.
Really?
Right, because they used to not believe, and now they're like a harsh believer. It's like someone who became sober.
Oh, yeah.
It's
God, yeah.
Oh, are you drinking? It's like, yeah, you used to fucking pour kegs on your head.
Right.
Yeah.
Tony, before actually, you recently, well, I guess in the last 10 years, wrote a novel based on your upbringing in Jehovah's Witness, but you were also a music journalist, so you had some interactions with Nick Cave as a music journalist?
Yeah, I got to interview him a few times. And that was, I mean, that was just utterly amazing and cool. I had to, you know, before meeting him, I had to put my journalist hat on, and it's just like, all right, I'm going in here because I got to get the story, and this is just a dude. And then I was, you know, and then after we had our time, I'd walk outside hyperventilating going, that was Nick Cave. They, you know, and then it's just so funny. People go, don't meet your heroes. I love meeting my heroes. The first time we met, they had me waiting in a conference room at the Prescott Hotel. I was waiting behind a barrier, and I got to hear the other journalists ask questions. And she, at the time, he had a mustache, and she says, "What's the significance of your mustache?" And he's just kind of, I just heard the silence and I'm sitting there cringing going, is this what I'm following? And then he just goes, next question.
Oh, wow.
And so I'm like, all right, cool. I'm like, hey, if I'm going to get a Mad Nick, I'm getting it on tape and that's cool with me.
Yeah.
So then his tour manager goes, he's about to get up and he's all, oh, hey, you have one more interview with Tony Duchesne. And I hear Nick go, ah, fuck. And I'm just like, I'm like, all right, cool. He's getting even more cantankerous. Let's do this thing. So I come around the corner and then he looks at me and he calls to the woman who had just interviewed him. He's all, hey, come here. He puts his arm around me and he said, Tony, what's the significance of your mustache? And I said, it shows a man has commitment. And he just looked at me and went, that's the answer.
Nice.
And then after that, we just had like the most beautiful conversation.
Really?
The tour manager's like, I'll come back in 20 minutes. Nick's all, no, I'll take care of this one. Don't worry about it.
Wow.
We ended up hanging out longer.
Oh, really? Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah.
Okay. I have a story that is maybe the opposite of that, which is
with Nick.
Yeah. Well, so was that the Grinder Man tour?
Oh, what tour was that? That might have been the Dig Lazarus Dig tour.
Okay. So
it might have been. Yeah.
I was doing music journalism for a while as well in the Bay Area. And I was actually more of a big birthday party guy, but there's so much bad seeds that I'm not very well versed in it. So this is like about 10 years ago or more. Someone just, who's a friend of mine who writes for a different publication, was like, we need someone to interview Nick Cave in San Francisco, and I thought maybe you'd want to do it. I'm like, I appreciate the thought, but he had this reputation as such a difficult interview that I was super intimidated about doing it. And at this point, I hadn't been doing a lot of profile interviews, but I was like, okay, I'm doing it for this magazine that I don't really know. I want to, you know, put a good foot forward with these guys. And I did it, but I was like, in the back of my head, I'm like, I don't know the depth of the catalog that well to like know what to ask him. And on top of which, then the publicist was like, just to remind you, this is a Grinder Man interview. This is not a Nick Cave interview. So it's the whole band. And I'm like, okay, so then now I have to think about what am I going to ask Warren Ellis? What am I going to ask like Jim Sclavunos? Like, and then, but obviously it's still a Nick Cave interview, even though,
right.
Like, Grinder Man is like, you know, like if David Bowie was Tin Machine, right? Like, no one cared about the other dudes, right? Like, no one cares. But at the same time, I was just so intimidated. Like, I watched, like, the Proposition, like, beforehand. I'm just like, wait, this has nothing to do with Grinder Man. I was just, like, trying to absorb as much of the ethos of Nick Cave as I could before I went in the room. And then I did this. I did so many dumb things. Like, I didn't really have a good list of, I didn't have a written out questions. I brought a video camera in there and they were just like, we're not doing video. I'm like, okay, we'll just leave the cap on. This is the only way I have to record this. So I just have a videotape with the audio of the interview.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
And then like, I just like fucking boned those questions so hard. They were so bad to the point where they were just like looking at each other, just like, what is this guy doing? And I'm just like, I credit the Nick Cave interview I did with why I don't do music interviews anymore. I don't do journalism anymore.
Really?
In my opinion. And it wasn't his fault. It was completely my fault.
Did you ask him about his mustache?
I didn't ask that question, but it was like, I asked a pretty bad question that I'm pretty sure, like, I don't even want to like repeat on here. It was like so bad. And like, there was no good answer to it. And it was just like, basically these guys, like these Australian dudes being like, what the fuck is this guy doing? But I will say at the very end of it, like he stood up and stretched his arms out and was like, wanted to give me a hug. Like he kind of knew that he had put me, like that I was like in a terrible state from doing this. Yeah. And he just kind of, and just said something nonsense like, there, it's all good. Something like that. Like he just, I got like pity hugged by Nick Cave for just boning this interview. And like I couldn't even transcribe it. I was like so embarrassed about the whole thing. I bought my friend dinner to help me transcribe it. I'm like, you're gonna have to listen to this videotape and just like transcribe these questions. It's fucking awful. And I think I just sent a raw transcript to the magazine. They wrote the thing. They just took some of the quotes and then wrote the thing. But my name is on the byline, so I'm just like, no more music journalism for me. I also just got to the point where I'm like, this guy is like a rock star. What's he gonna say to me? What question has not been asked of this dude at this point in time, you know? In like 2007 or whatever. So I just like really like overthought the whole thing and like just it made me so like I can't even look at this guy's stuff for a while. It just left such a mark on
cringe.
Me.
I interviewed John Schofield in college. I had a jazz radio program in my college radio, WIDR 89.1 FM, Kalamazoo, Michigan. And I interviewed John Schofield and he flossed his teeth during the entire interview.
Ew.
In the studio? Goddamn.
In the studio and then kept saying, we're not going to talk about that. I was like 23.
Yeah.
And he kept saying, we're not going to talk about it. And I was like, what about the time you lived with, he lived with Jaco Pastorius and Mike Stern in New York when they all played with Miles Davis and stuff. And I was like, that sounds awesome to have Jaco as a roommate. Did he do his dishes? He's like, we're not talking about that. I'm like, what? Why?
Don't open the door then.
Yeah. And then when it was over, he got really nice. And then it was like, where's the marijuana factory in Kalamazoo? And I was like, okay, this will work.
Isn't it weird that
maybe you should have got him stoned before the interview.
I think I should have, yeah.
Yeah.
It's weird that we end up doing a podcast now where all we do is talk to other people about stuff. But I guess it's just different when it's not like you're going in with this loaded expectation of someone. Who's like an icon, basically.
Exactly. And I think it shows that you and I apparently, even back then, had a desire to talk to interview people. I mean, you got to start fucking somewhere. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Let's update our listeners.
Sure.
So tell us about your novel/film.
Yeah, Confessions of a Teenage Jesus Jerk. We just had our San Francisco premiere last Saturday night.
Congrats.
Yeah, SF Indie Fest. And we had a lot of the cast came out there. Like the cast is so wonderful. It's just, we were just this fucked up, dysfunctional, loving family for so long, and it was so intense. And then, it's just the connections there. And Eric's on Madam Secretary now. He's executive producer on that. So to get him out of New York is really hard because he's always busy. And we got him flying in for a few hours to do Q&A and hang out. And he actually did Calix film close-ups while he was here.
Oh, nice.
So, yeah, what are we going back to? Confessions of a Teenage Jesus Jerk.
What is it about?
It's a novel set in the Jehovah's Witnesses, and it's a love story. I grew up a Jehovah's Witness. It took me a long time to feel okay to discuss it in public, because if you discuss it in public, you're apostate. Mm-hmm. So, I was reading memoirs that other ex-Jehovah's Witnesses had written, and it's all, woe is me, isn't this stupid? And I'm like, you know what? No, you got to go in as why we were there. Why were our parents converted? And yeah, it's a fucked up religion, don't get me wrong, but at the same time, why do people join? And then why do people stay in? And what are the good parts? Because people stay for, you know, a lot of it's socialization, a lot of it's... And a lot of it's all I knew. I mean, I didn't know anything else. But
where'd you grow up?
Millbrae, right by San Francisco Airport. Yeah. So I wanted to kind of write a story that was more just put the reader in as a Jehovah's Witness, and not to be the judge, just kind of show my experience and almost like a love story to what is part of my identity that I. I don't feel bad about it anymore. I actually kind of feel lucky as hell, because I don't think Eric Stoltz would have ever made a movie about my life if I grew up in a normal right, way and became an accountant.
No, definitely. So it's fiction, though. I mean, it's a narrative.
It's a, well, there's probably about 50% absolute true, where dialogue like is right on target. But I went in as fiction to nail the story beats, because Gabe, who's essentially the version of me, he's our hero. So I really wanted to nail the story beats of kind of the hero's journey. At the same time, I would have probably made a lot more money if it was a memoir and I talked more shit about it. But I didn't want to be the guy that goes, and then this happened, and woe is me. Mm-hmm. It's just like, you know what, people all grow up fucked up. We all got our fucked up stories.
Yeah. Amen. Yes, everybody does. And it's too bad. I mean, it'd be great if more people were able to like put that on paper or like into a show or, you know.
Yeah.
Because then they would be fucked up artists like the three of us, I suppose.
Exactly. It's, yeah, I just realized, oh, yeah, we all have our good stories, but how do you craft the good story? And that's where it is.
Well, do you have any, do you have any advice behind that? How do you do that?
It rewrites and knowing your characters and letting your characters be, letting them take their course. But in order for them to even take a course, you got to keep writing them and start this weird relationship with them. And then all of a sudden you're like, wait, that's outside of his parameters, even though I would do that. The choices that he could, you know, when you give a character, to make a character actually have character, you throw conflict at them as they go toward their goal and what their choices are and how they get out of that and what they learn and what gets them in even more trouble. That's essentially creating their narrative arc, where they'll have the limitations, or they'll have more knowledge at a certain point than I would have or I would understand. So.
Oh, interesting. And so, George, you have...
Yeah, I was going to just ask a question. Did you do the screenplay for your film? Or
yeah, I wrote the screenplay.
How did you have to approach that, like just taking your own work and then changing it to a screenplay format?
It was intense. I had to learn fast. When Eric said he wanted to do the book, he also said, you need to do the screenplay because we can't lose the voice.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, thank you and holy shit. I did a ton of research on, act one, act two, act three, what story beats, how many scenes can we get in? And then it was just about getting that book and dissecting just what needs to be in there. Mm-hmm. And it was, It was intense. I loved every. I mean, I loved it. I lost a lot of sleep. I lost a relationship. You know, it's
Are you
just
serious.
Oh yeah, it's like every. It's like almost everything. Well, it's probably my fault because I'm just, you know, maybe I'm not healthy enough to find a nice, healthy lady, right?
Wow.
So I'm trying to get to that point.
We could dig into that a little bit.
Yeah, yeah. And yeah, when, you know, it's like I got a divorce when the book was, you know, was on its way to coming out. I was in a relationship with someone when I got the call that I was going to write the screenplay. 4 months later, we were broken up. And she told me at the when we broke up, she's like, when I got that phone call, it just hurt my heart because I knew that was the end of us. And I'm looking at her like, the fuck you talking about? Just, and you can't enjoy my success? I'm glad you're gone.
Yeah. You know, everything's about me. So the fact that you got something good is not going to work.
Yeah, right? Yeah. So, but at the same time, what is my problem for maybe I'm the one that's... you know, maybe I like that little bit of like that little worship. Maybe I got some weird worship complex where I need to not have that. I need someone who's a little more, you know, who can
less a sycophant.
Yeah, I don't know. And I've chosen these people. Thanks, Dr. well, Paco.
The reason I said that is because this works perfectly in 20,000 Days on Earth.
Yes.
Like that whole scenario that you just went through, it seems as though that's one of the major themes that Nick was bringing up in this movie.
Yeah, yeah.
Would you agree?
Yeah. With his wife being his muse, and also how hard it is on her.
Yes. Yes. Exactly. Yeah. And you only see her for 8 seconds.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you don't see her face.
And you never see her face
I think they do an archive photo. But in that first scene, her hair is just all over her face and you never see her.
Yeah, she just rolls over.
You can ask my wife, Susie. She'll tell you. Because she's usually the one that's getting cooked. Because there is an understanding between us. A pact where every secret, sacred moment that exists between a husband and a wife is cannibalized. And ground up and spat out the other side in the form of a song, inflated and distorted and monstrous.
So this kind of begs a question, and I would put it to you. This is a pretty experimental documentary in the sense that it's a lot of setup. It's a lot of... it's closer to, like, I was saying... I feel like it's kind of like comedians in cars getting coffee in a weird way. Like when he's like driving people around and like, let's just talk about our relationship. And then it turns out that he's not driving. It's a car on a flatbed truck with all the multicams and everything. So I'm like, okay, this is a documentary that is more like an art piece than it is a documentary. The parts of it that are... And maybe I'm making an artificial rule about it. Like, it's fine that it can be kind of a fluid thing. It's just funny that it, like, was up for all these awards in England as a documentary. But I feel like in America, people would be like, well, that's not really a documentary.
It does bring the question of how much documentary is set up, just in general, when you're watching documentaries. Where, you know, like, this one's really set up. I mean, you really see the, you know, it's like... They didn't sit there and go, let's just stay the night at Nick's place. And when he wakes up in the morning, we'll have a great shot of him getting out of bed. You know, it's just like that was probably shot at like, you know, at noon. It's like, you know, they went through makeup.
That's probably not his wife. It's not his wife. I'm pretty sure.
It actually is.
It is? That is her?
Yeah. So that's okay. I just remember this from interviews and from when the movie came out. That's Susie laying
her
in the bed.
She just didn't want to show her face, even though she's a model.
Exactly.
She's like, I'm not going to pay for this.
Yeah. That's her job. Yeah, well, I mean, it's interesting because the opening sets up, there are a lot of themes in this doc. And it's like lately we've been doing a lot of docs where father issues are a big deal in some of the, you know, like we did Some Kind of Monster, which is about father.
Oh, yeah, with Dana Gould.
Yes.
I loved that one. I was loving that one. I can go on and on about that podcast.
Well, we can save some time for that. But father issues. I mean, obviously aging He talks about his friends. He talks about memory loss. And you were bringing up before we started recording about how he was like primping himself in the mirror.
Yeah.
Or even just looking at some imperfections of being 55 years old.
Yeah. And that's what I love about it, because it, you know, Nick Cave is essentially, you know, back in like the 90s, Nick Cave was like a god to me, you know, and this was someone who was far away, and I could see him at a show and he can get close and he might even point at me, you know, that's as much relationship as I'm going to have with this guy. And he's only going to make it to the United States once every 2 years to a tour on his record. And now, as I kind of like, as we all get older, it's Nick Cave also has insecurities. Nick Cave looks at, you know, he's like, he was looking in the mirror. He's worried about his presentation for photo shoots, for being on stage.
Like in terms of like his vanity, and it always struck me as very odd because his hairline seems to be moving year to year. Right. And like, I hate to be the one to call it out, because I'm just like, if anyone can like rep for being a cool ass bald man, it should be him. And
exactly.
So it seems weird when I'm like, hey, did he get plugs? What is going on? Like, it's creeping forward. His hairline is creeping forward. I'm like, if Nick fucking Cave has insecurity about his hairline, what good is it for the rest of us? You know, like, how are any of us going to make it through? It's like, Will Oldham is our next guy to look to. Like, I don't know who to talk. Who's going to be your icon for balding dudes?
You bring up a good point, because I've wanted to do an article on Nick Cave's hair loss and then hair gain. And but I can never bring myself to do it.
Yeah,
because, we're too close to the like it is a little bit like, yeah, the emperor has no clothes or something in a weird way. Yeah, like bringing him down to our level.
So I've noticed something else too, is that, you know, as you get older, your ears get bigger. And he always had his hair tucked behind his ears. Now his hair is very over his ears.
Yeah.
And then when he untucks it a bit, you see his ears are starting to get bigger. He's it looks like, you know, we can dirt on Nick. He's Nick Cave.
Well, we're
yeah,
not
Nick
like
Cave
body shaming him. We're just like, he is one of us. That's what made Jesus good, right? He's like one of us also, right?
One of us.
Yeah, it's just I find it intriguing that there has to be a presentation where I loved it when he was losing his hair. He looked
me too.
You know, Warren Ellis has no problem with his hair loss. He's just like letting it all out.
Yeah.
And that guy's, you know,
Warren Ellis is like a gnome wizard. He's like very much like a
He was making eels? The fuck was he making?
Yeah,
was it
in England, people eat eel in England, like lamprey or whatever. I mean, I've eaten eel in sushi, so I figure it's just like a dish over there. Yeah,
that dish looked nasty. It was like seaweed and eel, but wherever he's living looks fucking amazing,
well,
like the White Cliffs of Dover or something.
Well, that's the other question I have, is like, is that really Warren Ellis's house? Because like, the office is not Nick Cave's real office; it's a set design. The archive does not actually exist. Like, the archive is a set, which is a great premise for how you go through his life.
I didn't catch that.
I only got all this stuff from watching the DVD, because there's DVD extras and they kind of break
all
this stuff.
See, I bought
into
the archive thing.
I actually
thought that was real.
Yeah, I mean, it's plausible. I mean, Richard Hell sold his letters to the New York, to the Fales Library or something. Like, there's a point where all these people are going to need their stuff archived. Like, I had talked to the Prelingers about Jello Biafra's archive, but then I talked to Jello about it, and he's like, I'm my own archivist. I'm like, well, that doesn't work. You see, where there's going to be a breakdown in that at some point. That's not going to work.
That's how the cloud got invented.
Yeah. But is that actually Warren Ellis's house? I have no idea. And because in the DVD extras, you see there's like a prop person who's cutting the eel up. So just like, The whole thing is so set up in this weird way. It's very artificial, but then like the unscripted parts are like, obviously Warren Ellis is really telling this story about Nina Simone and about Jerry Lee Lewis. Those parts are authentic, and those parts feel like you're listening to a podcast. So then there's just this really elaborate setup. I don't know if you had any thoughts on that, Paco or Tony.
About the
kind of
setup
nature, yeah.
Well, it just reminded me, I mean, Errol Morris does that to the nth degree. I mean, his entire documentaries are reenactments and setups for the most part. I mean, the people who are talking to camera don't even know who's in the room, because he has that like interview-matron thing he does.
Right, right. You know? Interrogatron, yeah.
Interrogatron, yeah, where Errol's in a different room.
Interesting.
And there's no one in the room with them when they're talking because he feels like they get relaxed, a little more relaxed about it.
Huh.
Yeah.
But I mean, I liked in like the mise-en-scene kind of documentary style that was big in the 60s, 70s, 80s, early 90s. It's kind of out of flavor now. There's a lot mm-hmm. more setup and a lot more stylistic stuff. I was surprised there wasn't any animation in this one because there's anything made after 2006 has just tons of in Doc's head.
Right.
Tons of animation. I liked it. I actually... was when you first told me, I was like, I don't know. I thought it was a film. I remember when it came out and I was like, oh, it's this Nick Cave movie.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's gorgeously shot. The cinematography is beautiful.
Oh my God, yeah. It's beautiful. And then I watched it twice. I watched it last night and I got up and watched it again this morning because I was like, this is fucking good. This is really interesting. Mm-hmm. I like this kind of take on a documentary because there's obvious setups. And I mean, I shot a commercial once where I was in a car. And it had the same track lighting that goes over the windshield that makes it look like you're going by street lamps.
Right.
And I noticed mm-hmm. that, you know, I'm like, oh, yeah, there's four. Then there's a pause. Then there's four. And there's a, you know, it's like the Scooby-Doo thing or the the background.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The animation
is the same
loops.
Picture again every 4 seconds. Yeah. Anyways, I really liked this movie, this doc. I thought it was great. And Nick Cave is not somebody I know a lot about. I never really got into The Bad Seeds. I actually liked The Birthday Party more in mm-hmm. just how much I knew about those guys. But... I liked it. I thought it was really interesting and
well, you
easy
like Dirty Three too. You're a Dirty Three fan, right?
Holy shit, I love the Dirty Three. Yeah, that was a whole other thing.
Yeah, Warren Ellis being in those bands. Yeah.
And Warren Ellis looks like he could be in Duck Hunter now. You know? Like the British version of Duck Hunter. He's like, I could just see him wearing the old British, what's the one-eyed Jack? What's their flag called? I don't know.
I don't know either, but I got the reference right away.
Yes. Yeah, no, he definitely is like a Lord of the Rings, kind of a combination of like an elf and a hobbit. Yeah, for sure. The directors of this film, I kind of like went into a hole about them because it was once I watched these DVD footage, I'm like, so what is their connection? Like, they apparently had made a music video for these guys before, and they're Ian Forsythe and Jane Pollard, and they did also, they're like kind of like from an art school background, and they did a couple of recreation type films. Like, they did a recreation of the Cramps. Performance at the Napa mental institution. They did like a complete shot by shot remake of that with different like Holly Golightly playing like Poison Ivy. And so like they're really into this like recreation of performance. And so that kind of comes out in this. Like there's a lot, even though the performances are the only really completely uncontrolled things. Like all of the tracking shots and everything had to be set up and all the car stuff had to be set up. It's just like within this artificial construct, there's real interactions. For example, like we talked a little bit about Blixa Bargeld, who was famously in the band in Neubauten, and he left the band, and the first time they talk since he left the band is actually in this sequence where they're like just hanging out in a car, and like these people just show up in the car. Like it looks like Nick's just driving, and then all of a sudden someone's in the car next to him, and like that's like this other artificial thing. I'm like, is this a real conversation that is happening or a conversation in his head? But it's clearly like that part is what's said is totally unscripted, but there is clearly the setup of like, so you're gonna get in this weird flatbed truck with Nick, and he's going to be pretend to be driving like it's like one of his old green screen Disney movies or something.
Oh, I left basically because of our management and because I felt that I can't keep up a marriage and two bands.
Right.
Time was becoming a problem. I had no personal conflicts with you or anyone else in the band.
No, I
had no musical schisma either.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe, now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
When Blixa Bargeld left the band, I believe it was via email. I don't even think he got in touch.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm.
And,
yeah, it was email.
It's been kind of a mystery. And then to finally see Nick and Blixa together talking about it,
it wasn't animosity at all.
Yeah. No, and it was just kind of like just normal stuff, and it's really strange they couldn't bring it up, 14 years ago. I don't know how much like how bad it would have hurt at the time if they had a conversation, mm-hmm. but now we get to see them have the conversation later, where they're mutually, they have many years together, and they mutually admire each other, obviously. And I like how just forthright like Blixa is discussing, hey, I was trying to keep a marriage and two bands, and I wanted to keep the marriage, so I had to dump a band. He said it way cooler than I did, but that's kind of my summary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that kind of ties to what we were talking about earlier, this idea of like if you are going to wholeheartedly, single-mindedly pursue something creatively for your career, that can kind of make relationships difficult to maintain.
Yes.
Yes. I have had that as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I also like that with both Blixa and with Warren Ellis, he has like these people that are, it's not just that they're like second in command or something. I think he defers to these people. I think those are the only people he'll defer to are like Warren or like Blixa or someone who like, I completely respect your opinion.
Yeah, it's like he needs that. He needs, and even Mick Harvey for so many years.
Right.
Mick Harvey had, that's another narrative, but with Blixa, I think before that clip, he talks about the limitations of like working alone. And then when he has collaboration, then everything kind of gets flushed out. And Warren Ellis essentially took that place.
Mm-hmm.
It's really funny because Warren Ellis was just their, he was their violin player. I think he came in 94 or 96,
mm-hmm.
and then he just stuck with it for years and years. And then now, what they're creating is amazing. I mean, I love the direction they've gone after Blixa left the band,
mm-hmm.
and what they're doing now. It's like it was meant to be. It's so beautiful.
But I think that's also thing of like he's surrounded by people that are like sycophants to him probably most of the time. So someone that he can just be like, should I do this part differently? Should I do this again? Like someone he can just straight up like have that frank discussion with, I think is important in his
every
life.
Every artist needs somebody like that. Like my brutal critics are my best friends. And that's like I stopped going to open mics pretty much 100% to try out new material. I'll just try them out on my friends. Because they're really funny and they're brutally honest.
Yeah.
And they'll just be like, that's a low-hanging fruit. You're better than that.
Right.
Or that's really funny. Like, you should explore that, One of those things. Like, I don't need a horrible open mic experience. Like, I have good, brutal, funny friends.
Can you rent your friends out to me? Is that possible?
Yes, they're for rent.
Yeah, the best friends are the ones that go, this is a piece of shit.
Yeah.
And I almost don't need to know why. I just go, okay. And then I'll try to look at it and come back to it and go, what would you think of this, this, and this? And they'll be like, well, that's good. Why would you do that? And I want that. I want that. Like, just beat me up. I'm not in this to be, what do you call it? Well, I am in this to be loved,
yes.
But I'm not in this to not
to
do
right.
well.
Yeah.
I want to do the story as right as possible,
yes.
and get my ass kicked.
Well, and I think as you go along in your artistic endeavor, we always start off pretty solo, pretty like in our own little cover fort with the fan on, writing or thinking of a play or something. And then as you go on, you kind of have, you bring people into the fold and you have to learn how to use that collaborative spirit to help you out. I mean, I remember the first time I got into a sketch comedy group and we table read our stuff, I was so married to fucking everything. Any criticism hurt my fucking soul.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
6-7 years later, I was like, you're right, throw out the first page.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
Fuck it. Yeah.
It needs to be 10 minutes when it needs to be 2.5 minutes.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. You're like, we need a gay elf. It's essential.
Yeah. Nick just talks a lot about needing an editor, which is funny because there's so many songs in here that are so goddamn long. Like,
right,
they really go on too long, but I'm like, I'm not gonna tell him to cut anything. Like, who's gonna tell him to cut a line? Only like Warren can, basically.
Yeah,
well, he brings up Hannah Montana and Miley Cyrus.
Oh, yeah.
I was like, come on, really?
You didn't like that?
No, not necessarily. I just don't feel like they have earned a spot in a Nick Cave song. You know, I mean, they're the same person, but...
Well, can I play a game with you guys, actually? Because this exactly yes. dovetails into a game that I wrote for Perfect. You guys. So, in the film 20,000 Days on Earth, they're writing a song called Higgs Boson Blues. At first, it's Hannah Montana. Then you see later he's changed to Miley Cyrus, which is like you're losing a rhyme inherently. So I don't know why you would do that. But I wanted to play a little game with you guys. Paco and Tony Duchesne, both of you can play this game, which is name the author of this lyric. Is it Nick Cave, Tom Waits, or Miley Cyrus? That's the game we got ahead of us. Right
hey,
now.
Do we have a little? Let's put a little music under here.
It's just a. Is it a lyric? From Nick Cave, Tom Waits, or Miley Cyrus. Okay, that's the song.
Perfect. Dun, dun,
all right,
ding.
So you're going to get a reading from me, and I'm not going to do any of those voices, so that will not be the giveaway. Awesome. All right, here we go.
And then on our end, how do we chime
I'm going to go left to right, so Paco first, then Tony, because Tony, you know the Nick Cave lyrics generally more than probably either of us do. So I'll ask you individually after. I'll give you the choices again. So Here's the first one. Dog Boy, Atlas, Mandrake, the geeks, the hired hands. There was not one among them that did not cast an eye behind in the hope that the carny would return to his own kind. Paco, is that Nick Cave, Tom Waits, or Miley Cyrus?
I'm going with Tom Waits, my friend.
Tony, what do you say?
That's The Carney by Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds.
1 point for Tony, 0 points for Paco.
This is gonna be it's like being on Jeopardy with that Ken fucker.
I like how you call him the Ken fucker, because yes. I know exactly who you're talking about.
All right, so
man, I'm gonna fail.
So far, yeah, Paco, it's okay. It's a multiple choice, so you got one in three chance each time. All right, next lyrics. And the bricks are all scarred with jailhouse tattoos, and everyone is behaving like dogs. And the horses are coming down Violin Road, and Dutch is dead on his feet. Paco.
Do I go first?
Paco, who go first? Is that Nick Cave, Tom Waits, or Miley Cyrus?
That's got to be Miley Cyrus.
This one,
Tony.
I think it might be Tom Waits.
One point
sure.
for Tony, 0 points for Paco. It is Tom Waits, Ninth and Hennepin. That is the name of that song.
Yeah.
So, so far, it's no real contest. Here's another lyric. Yeah, when my world is falling apart, when there is no light to break up the dark, that's when I look at you. Is that Nick Cave, Tom Waits, or Miley Cyrus, Paco?
Miley.
Tony, what do you say?
I say Miley, too.
You both get a point. That is Miley Cyrus.
Oh, yeah.
The song
Miley.
Is called When I Look at You.
Nice. All right. Clever.
Here we go. This one, I think it will be a little bit of a stumper. I put on my coat of trumpets. Will she be there? Is my piccolo on straight? Is that Nick Cave, Tom Waits, or Miley Cyrus?
I'm going to go Nick Cave.
Tony.
Oh, man. I'm going to go a long shot and try Miley Cyrus on that one.
Paco, you got that correct. That is Mr. Clarinet
that was
by
Nick
the birthday
Cave?
Party. That was Nick Cave.
Oh,
I know.
What song is that?
It's Mr. Clarinet by the birthday party.
Oh,
so it wasn't a bad seed song.
Nice. You Nick Caved me.
I
was like, the fact that it's like anthropomorphized musical instruments will make you think it's Tom Waits, and then you went a whole other way with it. So I thought you were going to go for Tom Waits on that one. All right. Coming up, we got two more. You guys are actually almost even now. Paco's got 2 points. Tony's got 3. All right.
Dead heat.
Here, next lyric. The guy you're with, he's up and split. The chair next to you is free. And I hope that you don't fall in love with me. Is that Nick Cave, Tom Waits, or Miley Cyrus?
I'm going Miley on that one.
Tony.
I'm going Tom Waits on that one.
Tony, I feel like you've won the game already. That was Tom Waits.
Oh,
wow.
Hope you don't fall in love with me.
What song was that?
I think it's called Hope You Don't Fall in Love with Me. Huh. I didn't write it down. All right. last chance to just cinch it completely. And it's going to be the last question. Here we go. Here are the lyrics. It didn't take long for the room to fill with dust and these four walls come down around us. Is that Nick Cave, Tom Waits, or Miley Cyrus? Paco, what do you
think? Nick Cave.
I'm going to go Miley Cyrus.
Tony, you are the winner. That was Miley Cyrus, Four
it
Walls.
It was Miley Cyrus?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
I know. I was trying to find the most emo Miley Cyrus lyric. And so,
super emo.
Tony, you've got 5 out of 6. Paco, you got 2 out of 6. Our guest is a winner. That is how this game is played.
Ding, 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 ding. You know what you win? You win Carl Castle's voice on your answering machine.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh,
that
thank
is
you.
Such an old reference for a podcast. Okay.
It's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. That's what, okay. Do you ever listen to that?
Many years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So let's get into some more of the talking heads that we see. We are introduced to the therapist.
Oh, yeah.
At some point
the
in
therapist.
This doc, we see Nick opening up about his dad, for one.
Yeah.
What did you think about that scene, Tony?
I loved it. I love the guy who plays the therapist. I don't know who he is. But
he is a real therapist.
he's
an
really?
Actual therapist. Yeah, Darian Leader. Yeah, he's like the head of the founding member of the Center for Freudian Analysis. And he's born in Alameda for some
Alameda.
Reason, but he's British. So that happens. And he's like a Lacan expert too. Yeah, he wrote a book called Lacan for Beginners, which I need to read because I do not really know how any of that works. But yeah, so he's a real therapist, even though some of the people are actors, like all the people in the archive are actually actors, but they are actors who also are archivists, but it's not a real archive. So that's
right.
But yeah, Darian Leader is actually was picked by the directors because they knew he could actually like get deep into it with Nick.
That's why it felt so good, because you're sitting there and you kind of know Nick is going deep, like talking about his father. Talking about his first sexual experience, you know, what was the first time you felt that? What was it? The first time you had like noticed a woman,
right?
And then, I don't, you know, this may have been later in the film. How pornography, like in his apartment in Berlin,
It
was just like he was so into pornography and religion at the same time, religious icons. But yeah, you know, talking about a dad who died, I think when he was 19 years old, and how much that would affect somebody, especially at that time, because I don't know when the birthday party moved to London. If they were, they were like 20, or if that was right after that.
I think they moved pretty much right after. He said it was basically like he dropped out of college, and then his dad died, and then he took off, and that was like he talks about that, like that was. Why his relationship with his mother was kind of like, he was like, you know, still sending her things like, we got written up in the NME, you know, like he still kind of wanted her to like understand a little bit like what he was going through. But he was also like on heroin and stuff. So
right.
I'm sure
right.
it was like a hard time overall.
We're always looking for our parents to be like, you did great. You know, you always want that attaboy from your parents, no matter what age you are, you know.
Right, and during those scenes, doesn't he talk about, has your dad ever seen you live? And there was maybe two times. Yeah.
Yeah, when he's like, did you see it? And he's like, yeah, I saw it. I checked it out. Or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, God damn it, give me more. I need
more.
It was interesting because he said he looked like an angel, or he thought he was like an angel, even though it was like, you know, the birthday party, like notorious, like Australian, like, I don't know if scumbags is the right term, but just like, yeah, just dark, dark music.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, so then we're introduced to a guy that I had to look up, but you were telling me the actor's name.
Oh, Ray Winstone?
Ray Winstone, yeah.
Yeah, I didn't know who this person was just by, you know, because he was in a beard and stuff, but.
Well, you've seen him in a lot of stuff. He's in The Departed. He was in,
yeah.
I know he was in Quadrophenia. and which takes Sexy place beast. In Brighton. So yeah.
Right, and he's like, every time I come to Brighton, it fucking rains. And he's all pissed off. It's awesome. It's like you said, it's like a musician in cars with musicians getting eel.
Yeah.
Like that's, it's a great scene. And then he's like, oh, I'm just turning 56. How old are you? And then you just see Nick Cave's like pissed off face. It's like, don't you ask me my age.
I just didn't know that they were like actually good friends or like why they're in the car together.
Yeah, there was no explanation of who this person was or what the connection was.
Well, They just kind of show up like ghosts almost, like it's like a Christmas past kind of situation.
Well, you know what this reminded me of was Night on Earth.
Yeah.
The Jim Jarmusch film.
Oh, wow. That's a good comparison.
When I watched it this morning, and it had that feel, like, and that's such a great fucking film.
Oh yeah,
yeah. And it had that kind of it's very roomy and spacey and very emo, and it has this kind of almost, I hate to use the word dystopian, but it has kind of that, I guess maybe whatever Nick Cave does gives you that feeling of ennui or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
Throwing out words now, but yeah, it's interesting. And then also we were talking about this earlier, but then Kylie Minogue is one of his writers.
Do you think it's weird that she's in the back seat? I thought that immediately. I'm like, why is she in the back seat?
I didn't know if they did that just because it's a longer piece and it's easier to film when someone's in the back seat as a two shot. I don't know if they did it to set it up.
I mean, I also think his relationship with women is very strange, and like that kind of comes across in this. Like even his relationship with his wife, it's like when he meets his wife and is like blown away, it's just like every like construct of sexuality that has been cultural or whatever intrinsic, like he's like all the I dream of genies, everyone just like they're all magnify in this one woman. And it's just like, it's weird when you think about like how the lyrics of so many of these songs are just like, I killed my lover and threw her in a ditch. You know, like that's like so many of the lyrics are that. And not to say that that is like what it's about necessarily, because I'm not going to say like, he's like hates women, but it's like the material definitely, and like what the thing is, like women still love it. This is the thing that's crazy. Like women still love Nick Cave, but it's like really, because it's a lot of just like I murdered her in the woods. It's a lot of that kind of stuff, and like it's very strange. Yeah,
it's so dark and mysterious, and he's a crooner, and I don't know how these British rock stars stay so fucking skinny. Like, what is there like a secret diet book for these guys?
That was one of the questions. yeah, junkie. I asked him that once. I was like, how do you stay so skinny? And then he just said, oh, just eat what you want. And I'm like, that's not the answer, Nick. I'm asking you for me.
Yes, he's also of that Australian stock where he's like 6'6 or something. And so like he's just is like real thin, but like he's giant because he's a giant. So he's weighs a lot.
He's about 6'1.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. Everyone's tall to me.
Yeah, right. And then we're introduced to Warren, man. Like, when you first see him, you're like, oh, it's like his special needs friend that, like, helps clean up around the studio. Because he's on the floor with his, like, keyboard.
Right, that's right.
And I was like, who the fuck is this guy? And then in another clip, because I haven't seen recent pictures of him. I didn't know he had such long hair and a beard. And then in the back, he's on like this elliptic machine.
Yeah, that is a good, the workout machine, yeah.
He's on the workout machine like, it's like, oh, who's this guy? And then I'm like, oh my God, it's Warren Ellis. That's fucking awesome. Because he's like his Paul Schaefer. Right? I mean, he's his music director, basically.
I don't like that analogy.
I mean, Letterman to Schaefer, I mean.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, the Nick Cave talk show. Great. It's a great thing that has existed. Like, it is going to be like comedians in cars getting coffee with Nick Cave. That is really what the show should be from then on.
It's just him
and Shane McGowan in the car together. Like, just Shane's like, can we stop here? I need to pee. Like, why was Shane McGowan not in one of those cars? I mean, like, I feel like more association between them than him and Kylie, really, but.
But Kylie, well, I think, and they talked about this for a minute in that when that came out, I think that was on Murder Ballads. Mm-hmm. That was one of their biggest selling records because of Kylie.
Right. It's and like if Taylor Swift had done something with like, I don't know who the modern equivalent would be. I don't know. Yeah. But like, yeah, she was like the most famous Australian for probably 20 years or something.
Yeah. And I love that. If I remember right, that song was originally Blixa Bargeld played, sang the woman parts to it. Really? And there's a version of that out there. And then they finally got in touch with Kylie to do it in a studio on her end.
Yeah.
And then when they did it live, Blixa took her part when they didn't have Kylie around.
That's pretty much. Whenever I want to replace Kylie Minogue, I think Blixa Bargeld. Like, I think if you're going to reshoot Street Fighter, you could have Blixa Bargeld playing Kylie Minogue.
Yeah. Yeah.
If I ever want to date, you know, either Kylie Minogue or Blixa Bargeld, they're totally interchangeable. I could love them both.
Yes, exactly. One's just a cute Australian pop singer, and the other one's like an upset German guitar player.
What is the biggest Kylie? Is it Do the Locomotion? Like, come on, do the locomotion. Like, what would
but with like people like banging pans together my head. And like a cat screeching.
Yeah. That is, yeah, the Eisterzende Neubauten version of Can't Get You Out of My Head. I tried to drill my head open. You could not.
Oh my God. I still remember when my brother brought home one of their albums, and I was like, what the fuck is this? In a bad, like, I was like, I don't understand what this music is.
Neubauten?
Is it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I never, like, he was really into, like, industrial noise, like Helgrumilde, you know, all these German things. And I was just like, oh, I don't know. I like Supertramp. You know, like, I don't know what's going on with this stuff.
This makes me hurt.
So let's play Cast This Doc now that we're talking about the people. So here's a little music.
Gotta cast this doc. Cast this doc.
And this is a game we play called Cast This Doc. And so let's go with you, Tony. Who did you pick for Nick?
I picked Noah Taylor. There, Noah Taylor did a film called Shine. That's the first time I saw him. And the minute I just remember seeing him, I'm like, that could be Nick Cave's kid. And I've seen him do stuff now as he's older. And it's just like, he could carry the attitude, I think.
Yeah, I just saw him in Paddington 2, which is, you could also like throw Nick Cave in his role, I guess, in Paddington 2. Noah Taylor's always kind of been called like a little bit of like a Nick Cave. Like, did he ever play him in anything? I feel like I thought maybe he did play him in something, but
oh, that would be perfect casting then.
In the video 15 Feet of Pure White Snow by Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds, Noah Taylor's in the corner doing the smoke machine.
Oh, he's Australian too, so that's even more on point. I had a weird one because I also just started watching One More Time with Feeling after watching this. And have you seen that?
You know, I haven't seen it yet. I wanted to go see it, but the death of Nick Cave's son felt so like
personal.
It just felt so bad. I didn't know if I wanted to be there yet. I really need to see it though. Now at this point, I just haven't had a lot of time. But I need to sit down and put
I mean, I didn't finish it. I just started it right before we were getting in here. But it is like pretty like it's so weird to compare the two things, and I don't really want to compare them. They're like really different types of projects. But in any case, like he's a little bit older and like some major tragedy has occurred to him only about 2 years after making this film.
Wait, so, I didn't know his son died.
Yeah, yeah.
Which one?
One of the twins.
The blonde one or the brunette one?
I wish I knew.
Arthur. Wow, so I'm not sure. Yeah, I think it's Arthur
so
is one of the kids. Yeah, they're fraternal twins. And that happened like right after this came out, I believe, because that was 2015 when that happened.
What was the circumstances?
They were playing on the cliffs in Brighton, and he had, I guess he dropped some acid and fell off the cliff.
The kid did?
Yeah.
Whoa.
Is that the story?
Yeah, that
George?
Is what happened. I feel like this has kind of ruined the game somehow. I don't know if this is like we need redo the game setup.
No,
but
this is fine.
My point being, well, when I was watching this, just like it's only a couple years later, and I had this weird thought in one of the close-ups of Nick where I'm like, oh, Stephen Tobolowsky could play Nick Cave. Like he's a little bit of a thicker, older dude, but like facially...
Yeah.
They have a similar face. I don't know if you knew who Stephen Tobolowsky is.
No, who
Needle
is that?
Needle-Nose Ned from Groundhog Day. He's in a bunch of stuff.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, yeah, in a weird way. Like
that's
if you
a
look,
good one.
And a close-up, you could see it. Like, if it was just going to only be headshots, it could be Tobolowsky could do it.
And Silicon Valley, because I ran into him at a bar in Los Angeles, Stephen Tobolowsky. Uh-huh. And I was like, I loved you in Groundhog Day. And he's like, thanks. And I'm like, and Silicon Valley. And he's like, thanks.
Yeah, because he's sick of that.
Other.
He's sick of that.
I came up with
Ned.
Kevin Bacon.
Ooh.
Kevin Bacon.
Oh, the nose.
Yeah. Put a black wig on Kevin Bacon.
Yeah.
And then just let it sit in your mind for a second.
Wow. I can totally see it. I can totally see it. If you could do the voice, yeah, he could totally do it.
And he's got the skinny body too. At the same time, I could see him doing the stage performances and nailing them.
Yeah, well, he's a musician.
That's right.
He and his brothers have that shitty band.
I would also just say Kevin Bacon, but you need to put Peter Gallagher's eyebrows on him. That's the only.
All right.
Thing I was gonna say Peter Gallagher, just the eyebrows, nothing else. Like that was the only part.
So for me, for the therapist Darren Leader, I had Tony Shalhoub.
Interesting.
Playing him.
Yeah, I could see him. I could see Tony Shalhoub as a therapist, but the vibe of that dude was like so. He has a very weird on screen presence that Darren Leader does.
Yes, he did.
Yeah.
And then I'm sorry. The name of the actor that we talked. I guess he could play himself.
Oh, Ray Winstone. Ray Winstone.
Oh like, yeah, yeah. How can you get another? No, who's there's that other kind of crazy looking. British dude from In Bruges that was with Colin Farrell. What was his name?
Brendan Gleeson.
Brendan Gleeson, Irish guy. Yeah, he's also in Paddington 2. I think Paddington 2 is the secret casting of all of this. Yeah.
This episode has been sponsored by Paddington 2.
It's surprisingly good. Like, you don't need to have seen Paddington 1 to like it.
I do want just to like dive into
Tony had another casting for Blix of Bargold.
I was thinking Helen Mirren for Blix of Bargold because I think she can pull off his attitude probably be even more intimidating than Blixa if she went there. She's just...
That's amazing.
Yeah, I feel like, I don't know, there's just something about her that, she, you know, she's just adorable and amazing, but don't fuck with her. Right. She just kind of gives you that vibe.
Yeah.
And you had another pick for Warren Ellis, too.
Oh, Warren Ellis. I was thinking Jeff Bridges, Big Lebowski era. I just want it to be cartoony. Yeah. I almost think maybe he should be animated.
Oh wow, yeah.
And just like because he's
a CGI elf like in the whole.
Yes, he's like so other. It's just he's an alien to us.
Yeah. That's so awesome. I think all the casting ideas I had. Yeah.
So let's dovetail, though, into one of my absolute, maybe my favorite part of this movie is when they're talking about Nina Simone.
Yes.
Oh, God.
And they're in Warren's kitchen or whomever, wherever that place is. And we already see Nick already brings up, he already mentions Nina in a talk, I think with the therapist, when he's talking about just working, one of his early jobs working, and Nina was this crazy, because transformation's a big theme. Mm-hmm. In this doc as well. Transformative transformation. Matter of fact, it's in his closing lyrics of the song in this doc. So he's talking about Nina and she comes out and she's just like, ugh, just like this fierce woman, just like, ugh, and she's like intimidating the crowd with just like her clenched fists. And then she sits like dramatically at the piano. And by the end, people are enraptured and she's waving and sending kisses and stuff. And then they're in the kitchen with Warren and Warren apparently was in that gig.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. With Nick, because he's like, remember when we played with Nina? And he's like, oh my God, she was so intimidating. And I think their roadie or their manager was walking by her green room and noticed that she was seemed a little upset and kind of not into the gig. And he said, well, what can I do to make this better? And she said three words that I fucking love. She said, I need champagne, I need cocaine, and I need sausages. Oh my God, I busted out laughing when I heard that so much. I was like, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then he's like, so he left and he came back with champagne, cocaine, and sausages. And she was much happier about that. That is fucking awesome, man. Yeah. Did you ever get a chance to see Nina?
The documentary or her live?
Her live.
Never did, no.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. The doc's really good.
It's good, yeah.
What about, George, you ever get to see Nina?
I never got to see her perform, no. But yeah, that documentary is great. But like, I can sort of like, it's weird how it wouldn't show really like what she was like near the last couple years of her life. Like she had all the mental health issues, and I guess she was just angry all the time. And like, It's Dr. Simone, like going around yelling at people about stuff. So but I mean, she earned it, you know, like if anyone did,
she earned it.
People. So they all worshipped her. And then Jerry Lee Lewis, that story is pretty good too. I mean, that also goes into the thing about aging. You're talking about this idea of aging and like the titling this 20,000 Days on Earth. It has to tie in somehow, even though it's obviously not one day, right? This is like another artificial setup that is not actually a day. I like that they
pretend it's a day. You know, I know it's not, but let's just pretend it's 48 hours. And Nick just drives around with people and eats lunch and nothing but a thing. And then they're at Sydney Opera House, you know, on the other side of the earth, whatever.
Teaching some French kids to sing.
Oh, my God. That part is hilarious. Where Warren's directing the kids in the studio.
He's like, I was going to be a teacher, but then I discovered heroin. You know? Thing about this being set up, it doesn't bother anyone, huh? It doesn't bother you guys? I feel like it would bother me if I wasn't super interested in Nick Cave. Like, we watched this other film called Flames that is about this couple's relationship, and I'm just like, who's the third camera person when these people are having sex? Like, what is going on? And it just takes me out of it. But in this case, it's like, okay, it's like you're getting the most interior view of Nick Cave that you're probably gonna get, but he still doesn't feel vulnerable, really. He feels like he's still in control of the situation. Maybe the most vulnerable he's being is when he's in the car with Blixa. That actually feels like maybe the most tense. Even like that whole archive setup where he's just like, oh, yeah, that's when Tracy Pugh got peed on or whatever. Like that whole.
Oh, my God.
It's like he must have told this story a bunch of times, right? Because he has it like in his recall. He's like, oh, yeah, you have those photos because it's not really an archive that is being monitored by archivists. So I think you just have to be like, this is like a magical view of like a fantasy vision of him, but it's also about him maintaining this thing of like, I can't reboot my identity, right? Like that he says that in there. He's like, why would I want to? Like, this is me.
Right.
But like it's self-made man stuff. It's all about self-made man stuff.
And it's also straight on fucking brand. You know, if it was done differently, so it didn't seem Nick Cavey, then it would also probably have, like, if this was about Jeff Tweedy and it was this stylized and, you know, like come on. But it's so on brand for Nick Cave that it seems like a Nick Cave joint in a sense. You know?
Yeah.
Like it has that feel to it. So I think that works in a sense for me. But yeah, I mean, there are lots of themes in this. Like I said, transformation, aging, memory loss, friends, father issues. Is there something that you were surprised by in this that you didn't know, or something that you took away from this that you weren't expecting, Tony?
Oh, good question. What I really liked about it, and because when people try to track Nick Cave's life, there is one part. I mean, the archive part. I feel like the archive part is the weakest part of the movie.
Oh, really?
Because I don't care too much about. I want to know the now of Nick. And I feel like they do a good job of what's now of Nick. When I saw him in 1990, I was like, I'm so glad I get to see him before he dies.
Because
that was this old 30-year-old dude who was a junkie. I'm just like, wow, I'm getting to see him before he dies.
Wow.
And then he doesn't die.
Yeah.
And then I'm stuck buying his goddamn records until, you know, how many years later, I go into every single stupid show, being the fanboy that I am. But it's a testament to somebody who is putting the time in to actually continue to create and to continue to age with his songs. There's so many bands where they're not putting in the time anymore with Nick. I don't know if they bring it. Well, they do bring it up a bit. I mean, he is in the office 8 hours a day writing. His whole life is writing. And then, and even on tour, they used to party a lot more. But now when he's on tour, he's working on screenplays. He's writing a book.
Yeah.
When he's in the van and when he's in the hotel, there's work involved.
All of our days are numbered. We cannot afford to be idle. To act on a bad idea is better than to not act at all. Because the worth of the idea never becomes apparent until you do it. Sometimes this idea can be the smallest thing in the world. A little flame that you hunch over and cup with your hand and pray will not be extinguished by all the storm that howls about it. If you can hold on to that flame, great things can be constructed around it that are massive and powerful and world-changing. All held up by the tiniest of ideas.
So that was basically what you were talking about and what you do for your class and how you're saying like the kernel of the idea, just keep going forward, don't get distracted, keep pushing it, keep writing for it, and just basically build that universe, right? I mean, that's really important.
Yeah, and yeah, just keep the authority on it too. And I just love how he describes it as a flame, a small flame that you just have to kind of keep brightening, you know. I listen to every time I hear that, even when I watched it again before I knew we were going to record, it still just brings chills to me. Every time I'm just like, it gets me every time I hear that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think like the work ethic, it comes across so strongly in this, like the amount he's laboring over everything and just like his weird typing style that he seems to have. And even the fact that he wrote a novel when he was like just like living in a homemade loft in Berlin. And I've never read that novel. Have you read The Ass and the Angel? It seems like have you read it?
I did when it came out and I did not like it.
Yeah.
I read it and I was like, wow, somebody just said Nick Cave wrote a novel and they said, let's just not edit it. Let's go ahead and release it.
Right. Yeah. But I mean, I'm sure he didn't have an advance for that or anything. It was just purely something he seems to be driven by this mania and like keeping on like a monomaniacal track for creativity. I was thinking about how in this film he talks about his relationship to religion, or how he, even though he doesn't believe in God, in his works, there is sort of like a God, or there is like a judgment happening. And I was thinking about that a little bit, like, you know, growing up in a religious household yourself, and the religious imagery that is in a lot of this music, do you feel some connections with that stuff?
Oh, definitely. That's one of the reasons I really connected with Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds and their material. Were you asking about maybe my beliefs too? Is that what, or no?
I guess I was thinking more like you said that you think of him almost as, he's almost like a preacher in some ways. And then
yeah,
you
I really liked that he had a preacher style and a preacher delivery. Yeah. And even now his shows, it's almost like, you know, because he interacts so much more with the crowd. He goes into the crowd. He's the guy that now understands how to manipulate a whole crowd instead of just kind of like he was saying the front row. Yeah. And then you notice the tours after that, he's walking all the way to the back and clapping and getting the whole audience clapping and making them quiet. It feels like it could be a sort of a church. What isn't a church? You know, when you go see a band, it's elevating you on some spiritual level because music does that. Boy, I sounded really serious there.
No, you can be serious.
Can I be?
Yeah.
Well, all right, cool.
Talking about fucking religion, man. Shit tends to get people serious. Ugh, fucking religion. Jesus Christ. Yeah, but I mean, you're absolutely. I mean, there is. I mean, we also just did I Am Sam Kinison, and he was a former preacher.
Right, yeah.
Obviously turned comedian and has that kind of cadence. And I'm very much drawn to that cadence as well and the whole church idea. I just watched this video online. It's called Choir, 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 where in New York City they get just as many people they can shove into a room. They're taught how to sing the backup parts to rock and roll songs, and then they get a real rock and roll singer to come out and sing the song with 400 or 500 New Yorkers singing along with them. So David Byrne came out and sang Heroes by David Bowie with 500 New Yorkers who were just taught how to sing backup on this song like an hour earlier. So there is a beautiful part of the church idea where in a collective of human beings doing the same thing at the same time fucking lifts your spirits.
Yeah,
it works. It's true. It's just the charlatans and the con men,
right,
that are involved that make it suck. So you have that. But this has been awesome. And I thank you so much for bringing 20,000 Days on Earth to us, because I had never seen it and I'm glad I was able to. Do you have something to plug? Do you want to talk about your movie real quick and where people can see it and all that?
Yeah. It's actually premiering in Los Angeles on February 24th. And then it will be online on Amazon. And I believe DVD maybe in April or May. We're recording the DVD extra, the audio track for the extras in February. So
Confessions of a Teenage Jesus Jerk.
Yeah.
Awesome. That's awesome. Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
Thank you much, Tony. George, thank you, buddy.
Thank you, Paco. Thank you, Tony. We'll see you in the neighborhood.
I know. I'll see you next week, man.
Yeah, that's it.
Thanks for listening.
You can find more episodes of SupDoc, show notes, updates, and more at supdocpodcast.com.
We're on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at SupDocPodcast.
If you have comments, corrections, or want to suggest a documentary, email us at supdocpodcast@gmail.com.
The show is listener supported. You can donate to the show at patreon.com/supdocpodcast.
If you can't donate financially, please subscribe, comment, or tell a friend about SupDoc.
We'd like to thank Documentary News for their ongoing support.
SupDoc is produced by Will Scovel.
Our theme music is by David Siegel.